welcome to episode 6 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include local judge, tournament organiser, and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel.
Hey, guys.
Runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey there.
Two-time store champion and two-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hey, what's up?
2014 Adelaide Regional Champion and 2014 Australian National Champion, Jesse Marshall.
Hey.
We're going to start off the discussion tonight with a strategy segment on mulligans, mainly how to make a decision when it comes to mulliganing and how to recover from a bad mulligan, particularly as corp. This is something that a lot of, especially new players and players that are new to how the game works, can really struggle with sometimes. So, Jesse, how would you suggest someone go about their mulligan decisions and how to recover from an impossible hand?
It's definitely easier to mulligan as the runner than as the corporation, and you can mulligan more aggressively as runner. I probably mulligan probably about half the games as runner, half the games I play, and rarely get punished for that. Whereas as corporation, the risk of mulliganing is that you'll end up with a worse hand, and that will actually... The worst hand as corporation can see you lose the game on turn one, whereas the worst hand as runner can't see you lose the game on turn one. That's really the crux of it. So as corp, what are you looking for? You're looking for at least one or two pieces of ice. If you don't have any ice in your opening hand, it's generally a mulligan. The only way that it's not is if you have a Jackson Howard and maybe one agenda and three operations, then you might consider keeping it, but you generally want to play ice on your first turn or you're in trouble.
Do you think that ice is not the only thing you need to be looking for, but also economy cards? For instance, if you open a hand that's got four pieces of ice, an agenda, and no economy, do you think that's also a mulligan decision?
I would rarely mulligan that sort of hand, but it does depend on the sort of deck that you're playing. If you're playing Near Earth Hub and you're looking to score very early, it's generally not going to be good to keep that sort of hand. I guess you do have an agenda, so that's not too bad. I mean, if it's an agenda and four pieces of ice and the only thing you're missing is economy, I would rarely mulligan just for that. If you had five pieces of ice, no agendas and no economy, then you might consider mulliganing if you're a fast deck, but certainly the four ice, one agenda hand as a control or slower deck is fine. You can play out two pieces of ice and gain a credit on your first turn, and that's a really respectable first turn and hope to draw into some relevant cards from there.
Yeah, especially... A lot of those games where you do just draw one piece of ice, so long as you have a high density of end the run ice in your deck, often that will save you a first turn of being hit by something hard like a legwork or a count siphon, or save you the first turn of being face checked and just having the run not end. So I think this is something of a throwback to our episode a few weeks ago about corp deck construction. The ability to mulligan safely and the ability to draw a hand of five cards that's relatively safe to open the game with is actually a deck building exercise, not necessarily just an exercise in probability or strategy.
I think that usually it depends on the deck that I'm playing against and the specifics of the matchup. Like, I usually don't like mulliganing that much as corp because I'm quite risk averse. And I usually will keep a hand if it has at least a reasonable game plan, even if the game plan is not optimal. But usually I'm looking for, against an aggressive runner, I want at least two pieces of ice. And against a slower runner, I want an agenda that I can score early or something to kickstart my game plan. Something which will allow me to pressure the runner early, even if my subsequent draws aren't that good. As I said, I'll usually keep most hands. I don't like mulliganing that much as corp.
What would we suggest for those bad situations where you mulligan away your first hand as corp, you draw your second five, and maybe it's a hand with a few agendas or no economy, no ice? A lot of new players might just think, oh, well, you know, there goes the game. I've automatically lost. What are some of the advice we could give to players that might feel that way?
Straight up, don't make that signal. I know that having a calm, collected appearance and having a calm face is one of my key strengths when I play. And I think a lot of people do comment that I'll be in situations where I'll just have 14 points worth of agendas in 10 cards or something. And, you know, my opponent would never be able to see it. And so it's incredibly important not to signal the fact that your game isn't going well. Because when your game isn't going well and your opponent knows it, they're going to punish you for it. They're going to pressure you for it. So being able to be in a position where you can just play an asset, play a piece of ice that you do have, or score through a one-point agenda that you do have. Maybe you're playing Wayland and you do have a hostile takeover. It's a respectable first turn just to score it through. Or it's a respectable first turn to score through a breaking news with a shipment from Sansan. Do something that looks like a game plan, and then maybe later follow it up with something that you actually want to do. But under no circumstance do you want to signal that strongly that your game plan is going awfully.
It's very important that you act the same way whether you're winning or losing. This might seem like it doesn't have that much to do with Netrunner, but I see a lot of people who wear their emotions on their sleeve, and it's really easy to sculpt your game plan against those kind of people. If their game isn't going well, they'll show that their game isn't going well, and maybe you don't have to worry as much about being safe, and you can be a bit more aggressive. Of course, you can bluff like as the corp, but I think it's just better to be reserved regardless of what you do.
I think the most important thing to recover from a bad mulligan is to know what your outs are, and that's something very important, whatever the stage in the game. But certainly in this sort of situation, perhaps if you have four agendas in the hand that you mulligan into, knowing what you need to do to get back into the game, what your deck is able to deliver up to you that's going to stabilize you is important, as well as making sure that you minimize the chance that the runner's going to do the things that are going to punish you. So Shieldsy spoke really well about the importance of not showing that you're upset, not sighing and dropping your shoulders and slamming your hand down on the table and saying, well, I might as well just go to the next game. Because then your opponent is just going to run your hand four times and steal those four agendas and you're going to lose the game. If instead you say, oh, this looks good, you draw your first card, it's an ice, you play it out, you gain a couple of credits, or you install an asset in a remote server, you're sweet. Even if you don't draw the ice, if you draw a couple of times, you find like a hedge fund or something, play the hedge fund, look happy, you end up with four agendas in your hand, they still might not run. You've got to maximize the chance in terms of the things you do. Drawing cards is a good way to try and find ice. Maximize the chance in terms of those things that you do to find the outs, but also minimize the chance that they're going to do the things that are going to hurt you.
Well, the one thing that I wanted to mention is that for runner mulligans particularly, don't feel pressured to mulligan towards one card. I think that a lot of times, particularly with a lot of decks out there, that's probably a mistake. You're probably better off keeping a generally, a good hand as opposed to trying to get a good hand with an account siphon, for instance.
Yeah, having a good opening game plan is about having a consistent way to know what a good hand looks like. And certainly I've, tested a lot of decks out there that when I first started playing, I had this massive affiliation for professional contacts. And so I tried to build a deck with three professional contacts and three hostages, and I wanted to get it all the time. So I played Andromeda, nine opening card hand, three hostages, three professional contacts, and I mulliganed if I didn't have one of those two cards. The deck was awful. It was horribly inconsistent. I was playing an archetype that was meant to be consistent, but the way I was doing it was in fact inconsistent. And mulliganing is about reducing inconsistency. So make sure that you build your deck in such a way that when you mulligan in a way a hand that is actually unsavable, and your deck most likely will reward you.
Moving on, a couple of weeks ago we did a deck building primer on Corporation. So today we're going to do a deck building primer on Runner. So we're just going to cover a few of the basics, like what cards you have to include in your Runner deck, how to spread out your icebreakers. So Liam, when you sit down to build a new Runner deck, what's your step A?
The first thing I want to identify is why I particularly want to build this deck. And I think for maybe just the sake of example, when I moved away from Noise, the reason I did so was because I found I had a very difficult time playing Noise's strategy of separating ice and destroying with Parasite in the format that was very laden with cheap ice and fast decks that utilized cheap ice very aggressively, like fast advanced decks that used Jackson as well. So I had this very split game plan that wanted to aggressively punish corps for something they were actually becoming very resilient to. So in turn, I tried to build a deck that would actually punish them for being that strategy, for playing ice that was cheap and permissible by playing AI breakers, playing a Crypsis deck, or playing a deck that let me have cheap breakers in play and then run with regular impunity with something like Fairy. Identifying why exactly you're building a deck and identifying exactly what you intend to beat will then give you a whole myriad of questions that you can then answer. And answering these questions one by one in such a fashion that is internally consistent but not excessive is the trick, I think, in my particular strategy.
Jesse, does your runner deck building strategy differ in any way to Liam's opening?
Yeah, understanding what your identity is trying to do, but also what the particular archetype you're building is trying to do. If you are trying to access a lot of cards early from central servers, you're probably going to need some icebreakers, and you're going to need a way to find them, and you're going to need something to do in the late game to either maintain a credit advantage and keep accessing those central servers as the ice become bigger from the corp, or you're going to need a way to deny the corp money or something like that. So yeah, understanding what you're trying to do, how you're going to do it in each of the stages of the game, and making sure you've got enough money to do it is really the crux of it.
I would say that one of my biggest weaknesses is probably my runner deck building. I think corp I've learnt a bit, but runner I'm actually quite weak. So I tend to take existing builds and then play them a lot to learn what to change in them. So I'm definitely not an expert on building something from scratch, that's for sure.
One of the more advanced ideas is, as a runner, it can be really tempting, particularly in Anarch, to include far too many programs in your deck. One thing Wilfie mentioned a couple of weeks ago was that icebreakers, when you don't need them, either because the corp doesn't have the ice type or because you've already got an icebreaker of that type in play, are really bad cards to draw because they actually do nothing at that point. So if you have too many icebreakers or too many programs in your deck, that's really bad. And you're going to generally be drawing dead cards. If you don't have enough economy, if you don't have enough ways to draw cards, and if you don't have enough ways to punish the corporation later in the game with multi-access, then you're not going to win many games.
We often get caught up in this idea that Netrunner is a living card game, and so we want to play with our cards. And playing as the corp quite a lot, it's fundamental that we play our cards. We win with our cards, we win with our agendas. But the runner doesn't actually need to play a card all game. The runner can point and say run, and that is enough for them to potentially win a game. And yes, runners do want to play cards, they want to play icebreakers, because the corp is forcing them to interact. But at a fundamental level, the runner doesn't necessarily need to interact. So I find that often I want to not lean into the necessity to be reactive to what the corp is trying to do, but rather I want to be reflexive of this intrinsic need to score. So cards like Inside Job, I think, are quite good, or cards like Crypsis that let me attack remote servers quite aggressively and stop the corp scoring by letting me score, I think are good strategies, and that's where I normally try to start building a deck.
Lastly, do we think there's any sort of hard and fast rule as to the density of your programs, as Jesse mentioned, or the density of your event cards? Is it something to take into consideration if you're playing a faction like Criminal that has a lot of tutors, or a faction like Shaper, which has access to SMC? Should you then maybe not put all three Corrodors in, just keep it to one? Or is that something that really just depends on the idea of the deck in general?
I guess one thing that's really worth mentioning there is the power of upon successful run triggered effects. As Liam said, running is the most powerful action that a runner can do, and if you can play an event that also gives you a run, that's really powerful. Cards like Dirty Laundry, which for your click you get to make a run, you get to access cards in that server, and you get a credit benefit at the end of it, is really powerful. Cards like Desperado, Data Sucker, etc., all those cards that reward you for successful runs are extremely powerful components of good runner decks.
I think we can possibly go a little bit deeper here in talking about breaker suites in general. Every runner deck's going to need a breaker suite. They're going to need to be able to get through code gates that end the run, barriers that end the run, and sentries that will trash the programs. And I think it's really important that we recognize that each faction often ends up with very different looking breaker suites. We often see a good suite of Anarch breakers coming in, notably the Corroda, which is our most common barrier breaker, and Mimic, which is our most common sentry breaker. But Shapers have access to both Gordian Blade and Zoo Keymaster, which are great at breaking code gates and which don't have the same restrictions that Yogg has. So often we find that the Shapers breaker suite looks fundamentally different to how the Criminal breaker suite would look, which again, they get access to things like Femme at a lower cost, or access to the Central breaker suite at a lower cost.
Brian, you asked earlier about whether it's worth playing three copies of every breaker or multiple copies of breakers when you're playing tutors, like self-modifying code, or whether you should alter your deck makeup to take account of the fact that you've got easier access to selection of programs. And I definitely think that that's worth doing. It's worth cutting down on the numbers of programs that you're playing and utilizing the power of those tutors, such as self-modifying code or special order, to be able to play less copies of those programs and therefore have less redundant cards in your deck. Yes, that will expose you to program trashing a little more, but you can find catch-all ways to deal with that, such as Crypsis or such as Atman, that are customizable and will let you get through things when you accidentally or inadvertently or unfortunately lose all of your breakers of one type. So you can use those tutors and use those powerful tutoring effects to reduce the number of each break you have to play, and you can still, with one card like Crypsis or Atman, reduce the chance that you're going to be left without the ability to get past any particular piece of ice.
I just want to come back to the point that icebreakers are really all or nothing, which I think is extremely important and makes runner decks be built fundamentally differently to corp decks. So corp cards, usually you want to play cards which are good throughout the game. Like if you draw an ice, it might not be so great later, but it will still have some effect, whereas runner cards like icebreakers, which are so essential, in a lot of situations just won't be useful at all. So you really want to minimize the number of those cards you play and play more flexible cards, such as events which will get you in without needing a breaker, or things which support that. So I think that's really important. Runners who are deck building are mindful of the fact that they don't just add so many icebreakers because it's so important to have icebreakers, but find alternative ways to collect icebreakers and get accesses such that they're not stuck in the position where they draw too many redundant cards over the course of the game.
And although it is important to make sure that you're drawing less redundant cards over the course of the game, we got to be careful here and not go too deep on that notion and actually get caught out in something of a trap. Although playing only Crypsis will let you draw absolutely no redundant cards through the course of the game, Crypsis itself is very inefficient as a breaker. So if you have Crypsis as a breaker and maybe something like a Kurotha or something like a Yogg backing it up, you'll find that you need to use the Crypsis significantly less, and that actually increases its efficiency because you only need to use it then for the sentries. And this is a general misconception that I think we see in what turned out to be a lot of Tier 2 or Tier 3 styles, or styles that we've tried playing and going all in on one type of strategy, maybe like Darwin, or maybe like Knight, or like Ice Carvers, and everything just turns lopsided. You are playing a very linear, consistent strategy and hoping to optimize on it. When you lose that kind of versatility, although you gain a virtual advantage by not drawing different effects that then become redundant, you actually lose a large advantage in terms of not in terms of consistency, but in terms of efficiency in your breaker suite. Yogg is incredibly efficient, but Crypsis isn't. But together, they're quite good as a suite. And this is why we're always going to address the breaker suite. The suite is what you have in play and how you can develop that rig to be more efficient as the game goes on.
Moving on to our next segment, we're going to do a corp deck tech on Hasbioroid Glacier. Tom, you've piloted this deck in the past. What can you tell us about it, the general strategy behind the deck?
Sure. So Glacier's probably been around for quite a while. The general idea behind it is you're playing, rather than fast advance where you're trying to score out of hand, Glacier is almost strictly trying to score off the field, particularly scoring bigger agendas. So you see a lot of 5/3s played in a lot of these builds, particularly priority requisition, where you do get a really big advantage for the risk of playing a 5/3. The reason that I wanted to play this style of deck is mostly because I just hadn't been doing that for a long time. Been playing a lot of fast advance because that was the thing to play. And it feels really different playing a deck that has a really low agenda count and also gets to make a lot of money. I think in one of the original lists that I played at the Adelaide Regionals, I was actually playing 15 economy cards, which is, you'd see like a runner playing that many economy cards, rarely a corp. So essentially the game plan is to build up a whole bunch of credits, get down your defenses early, you generally run a lot of ice, sit behind on like a Melange Mining Corp or your Adonis campaigns, your Eve campaigns, and get to the point where you can start putting down these 5/3s, create scoring windows because your ice is so expensive to get through, and also defend those with things like Ash and Corporate Troubleshooter. Make sure even if they do have the cash to get in, that you've got that extra fail safe.
Do you find that having a low number of agendas but having them have a high point count is a bit risky? And do you find that that affects how you play, that it might not be as good to draw an agenda early because of how much you have to protect it because of how vulnerable it is to getting stolen.
It's both a strength and a weakness of the deck. It's a strength because I've maybe played 40 or 50 games with the deck. The amount of times where I got agenda flooded, I can count on one hand. But in saying that, when you do have those hands where maybe you get an itchy and an end the run ice, and you've got a 3-pointer in hand, you do play differently. You know, you might defend it a bit more aggressively because it is worth 3 points. And the other side of things is, unlike a lot of these fast advanced lists where you do get to play a lot of 3-2s or a lot of 4-2s, oftentimes you can't be aggressive because you just don't have the agenda in hand. You know, if they start time walking themselves to do something or they hit an itchy and lose their field, you're less likely to have that agenda to push through and to keep the pressure on.
Would you say, Tom, that this deck really wants to get to the late game as quick as possible and that it's maybe in the runner's best interest to be aggressive as possible in the early game before you've got your thick ice rezzed?
Yes, definitely. The runner definitely wants to be aggressive. I think what this deck has to rely on early on when that happens is just chancing it that the runner doesn't hit things. I mean, with only 8 agendas in the deck, you know, you just have to cross your fingers that they don't hit a couple of R&D. And I find that playing this deck, oftentimes you kind of have to put a lot of faith in that type of stuff. Save off from rezzing an ice on R&D because you want to float some credits and just say, well, fingers crossed. In terms of wanting to progress to the late game as quick as possible, I don't think that's necessarily where you want to be, especially because a lot of runner decks out there can still outpace you even then. Even if you do res a bunch of toll booths and a bunch of Heimdalls and stuff like that, they can still get through there. I think what you more want to do is, rather than trying to create these scoring windows to score small agendas like others would, or to score out of hand, you want to create scoring windows where you can get those 5-3s going. So it's completely different, because rather than creating a one turn window, you're trying to create a 2-turn window. So it just kind of plays a little bit differently in that aspect.
I often find that the best way to protect an agenda from the runner is to score it. How do you feel about not necessarily having that option?
One of the things is I did get off this deck at about the same time that Domestic Sleepers came out. And whilst that's totally different because Domestic Sleepers isn't really worth anything, I did kind of want to try it just to have that extra flexibility of being, you know, if you do score 2 3-pointers, then that's the 7th point. But I don't think it's that big a deal. Like I said, you get agenda flooded so few times that, you know, if you've got 1 or 2 agendas in hand, it's really not that big a deal. You don't need to just throw the agenda away and just be like, yeah.
How important are the upgrades like Corporate Troubleshooter and Ash in this archetype?
Firstly, Ash is, in my opinion, the best upgrade for this archetype, like no question. The thing is what you do outside of the 3 Ashes. And I've tinkered with a couple of different things. I actually started running Caprice Nisei. I've just found that so many times the point at which you're rezzing the upgrade is after you've rezzed a toll booth and you've rezzed like an Eli and you've rezzed an Ichi on one server. And you just sometimes didn't have any credits left at that stage. So she's completely useless. Whereas Ash, at least it's, you know, 4 credits or something. Hopefully they're dry. What I did try and really like was Corporate Troubleshooter, just because you're running so many, you're already running rotos, you've got itchies, and just pumping it up and blowing them out, even if it's only costing you a couple of credits. Not a lot of people factor that in, because Corporate Troubleshooter just hasn't seen play for quite a long time.
I suppose that if a runner's always trying to play around the Corporate Troubleshooter in a server, the Corporate Troubleshooter Roto Turret server, you could install any kind of upgrade in the route, and it's possible they just won't run there while they have less money.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of lists, I would only really run the 1 Troubleshooter. I think going more than 4 upgrades is probably a bit too many. Like I said, you really just want to have money to do stuff and ice to protect yourself whilst you're doing said stuff. Going too deep on the upgrades may affect your consistency in that area.
So do you find that your consistency is also affected by the the trash ability of your assets.
Yeah, it's definitely not a non-factor, especially off the top of the deck. I think you're always going to be happy to see them pay five if they're trashing an Eve off the top of the deck. That's fine. It does come into play, you know, particularly with Maker's Eye and stuff like that, where they can kind of clear out a whole bunch of things. However, you kind of protect yourself in that aspect, because generally your central servers, your R&D most importantly, is going to be quite iced up. So it is, if you're in a position where they are accessing it multiple times in one turn, you're probably having a pretty bad game anyway. On the flip side of things, so when they're accessing stuff that's installed, I found that with this deck, you're happy to have the Eves trashed, but with Adonises, you don't want to be throwing them out unprotected. A lot of the time, I like to play an Adonis, protect it up, gain some credits off of it, and then once it's cleared after the four turns, start using that server as the scoring server. I found that that usually worked out quite well.
Lastly, we're just going to dive into the mailbag here. We have a question from Curtis W. What card do you guys think is the most underrated for both Corp and the Runner?
Yeah, I think one of the most underrated cards for the Runner at the moment is Daily Casts. I know I'm sort of on this bandwagon a bit, but I don't see many people playing Daily Cast at tournaments. It may be different in your area, wherever you're listening, but certainly around here, not a lot of people playing Daily Cast in their runner decks, and I think it is one of the best clickless economy cards you can have. For me, Dirty Laundry, Daily Cast, and Sure Gamble are the economy package that I like to start most of my runner decks with.
And as for a Corp, an underrated Corp card, I really think Paperwall is quite underrated. I know I don't really see many people other than myself and Wilfie play it, especially here in Melbourne. I think particularly in combination with Eli and in combination with no other barriers, Paperwall and Eli make a great tag team that both demands Kuroda and punishes it. And it's so cheap to get online. It's just really good.
Well, that's all we have time for tonight. If you'd like your questions or topics answered by the panel, you can shoot us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com, or alternatively, send us something on our Facebook wall. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. We look forward to seeing you again soon. See you guys.
Take it easy.
Enjoy. Bye.
See you guys.